What's going on, everyone? Welcome to Dipped in Tone. I'm Rhett.
I'm Zach.
We're back at it again.
We say that every time.
Yeah.
I think every podcast says that. Well, at least all the ones I'm
consistency is good. Like, people, you know, you start to cause anxiety in people. We start
just say,
changing
you're
stuff
back.
Up.
The people
you're
listening,
back.
You're back. Listening
We've
to
not
us.
Left. We've been here the whole time. We haven't gone anywhere. Haven't left this room. What's going on?
Man, just got back from Chicago. Went to shoot some videos at CME. Very fun.
Yeah.
I had one of the best things I've ever eaten, which was really exciting. It was a carnitas fried rice at this place.
Ooh.
And it was, it was real good.
Thank you not saying deep dish pizza. It's not pizza. It's casserole. But yeah.
Yeah. I'll eat it, but
it's fine.
It's not my favorite.
It's not pizza. It's just not.
Yeah. No, it is a casserole.
It's a casserole.
Or more of a traditional pie, I guess.
Yeah. Sorry,
well,
Chicago.
Pie has a top.
I love right? Chicago. What else did you do while you were there? You just went to, you ate one great meal and went to see me?
No, we went to the Art Institute, and Morgan and I went to CME. We went, we did the architectural tour. That was really
cool.
Fun on the boat. Everyone said, oh, it's great. And I thought, really? And it was really fun. And just, just gallivanted around town. It took it easy without the kiddo. But usually, like, after about 2 days, we're like, I'm ready to go home. I'm ready to see her.
I'm taking Tilly there. She's never been to Chicago. We're going in August for Fretboard Summit. And
right.
Yeah, I love Chicago. It's one of my favorite cities in the summertime.
Yeah.
But not one of my favorite places in the wintertime, but nice.
Yeah, we did the cloud bar thing and, like, you know, the sunset and the, you know, just very touristy stuff, but it was fun. It was fun.
Cool.
What about you?
Man, we've been traveling a lot. Tilly's race season is starting up. If you don't know, my wife is a freelance photographer with a focus on cycling, like professional cycling, the gravel racing scene. So actually, this week we're going to Monterey, California for Sea Otter Classic, which is kind of the first big race of her calendar. So it's this mountain bike race that starts on the Laguna Seca race track, and then it, like, jumps off and goes around, and it's also a trade show. So it's kind of like Bike NAMM in a way.
Oh.
So they, like, turn the infield of the track into this giant bike trade show, which we've never been to before. So I'm really, really excited. I love bikes. I love cycling. And,
sounds fun.
Yeah. Getting to see these pro riders, man, I know I've talked about it before ad nauseum, but dude, it's wild. It is wild seeing how fast these people are. They're
right.
Super. And this is an Olympic year too. So you're going to see a lot of these riders at the Olympics in Paris. And so, yeah, otherwise been working on some stuff. We did another big session of Live to Tape last week. We tracked 7 new episodes of Live to Tape. So that'll be coming out on the channel in the next coming months, which I'm really excited about. So
sweet.
Doing a lot of work.
Got to get me down there doing something.
Dude, I'm telling you.
Just standing around.
I'm going to revamp. The reason we did 7 at one time is because I'm about to completely gut this room upstairs and revamp it, like redo it.
Right.
New desk, new everything, because I'm adding more channels. We keep running into this problem downstairs when we have full sessions where I just run out of channels. And so that's all very nerdy and technical. But once I get all that stuff done and revamped this summer, have you come down and we'll do some tracking.
Sure. I'm just let me know so I can practice.
Nice. Okay.
Well,
should we thank the sponsor?
Let's thank our sponsor. Our sponsor this episode is the one and only Chase Bliss. So
yes.
If you want to get 10% off your next Chase Bliss pedal on chasebliss.com, use coupon code DIPPED. And I don't know, Rhett, what do you think about Chase Bliss pedals?
I mean, I genuinely am a huge fan of theirs. I love pretty much everything they do, but I actually want to plug sort of something adjacent to Chase Bliss, which is this guitar player on Instagram named juice.a.cuse. If you haven't seen or heard him on Instagram, it is wild. I've got a blown phone speaker here, but, like, the way he utilizes the mood and the other Chase Bliss stuff, it's so cool, man.
Nice.
Yeah, I've been following him and he's doing stuff. I've played the mood and the mood Mark II for a few years, and he's pulling sounds out of it that I've never thought about getting before. So yeah, I'm a huge fan. I think the mood Mark II.
Do all these people share all the little settings and whatnot?
I don't know. I haven't seen him share the stuff, but it would be really helpful because I would like to steal some of these sounds.
Yeah, just have like a picture with your phone. But yeah, they just recently released the Mood Mark II, and it's beautiful. I like the new design of it.
Oh, the colors are so awesome, man.
It looks great.
Everything they do, their aesthetic and everything. I mean, so yeah, thank you, Chase Bliss, for sponsoring today's episode. Get 10% off your next order via the discount code in the description box down below. And also, join us on Patreon. You can get access to special tiers. You can get access to our live recordings when we're actually taping the show and ask us questions and Q&A content. And it's a great way to support what we're doing over here if you like Dipped in Tone. And also, please subscribe. We've been looking at the analytics, and still, I think, on this channel, like 70% of the people that watch on a normal basis are not subscribed. So it does help us out when you hit that subscribe button. So
easy, thank you. Easy. It's free. Just click it. Just click it, man. It's free. And the bell. Click the bell. So today we have a very special guest, one and only Mr. Chris Buck. Really cool guy. Known him for a long time. And man, what a guitar player. So.
And great taste in watches, too.
Yes, indeed you do.
All right. Without further ado, here's Chris Buck. Chris, what's up, man?
Hey, Rhett. How's it going, man?
Good. Thank you for joining us today. Very excited to have you on the podcast. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah. No, thank you for having me.
Nice, man. So, okay. I want to get right into it here. Let's talk about RevStar. What made you choose RevStar? Why did you go with them? Talk about your guitar. What do you like about it? What made you go down that path?
I think as much as anything, obviously there is an inherent like of the RevStar. I wouldn't be playing it if it didn't come down to that. But I think initially, I guess I've always probably been a little bit disingenuous in regards to the initial kind of catalyst of why I picked one up. And as much as there was a massive part of that was liking the guitar and being intrigued by it, I remember going into a music store not long after they were released and seeing a kind of big display of them on the wall, liking the fact initially that they were it kind of harked back to the kind of SG 1000, 2000s kind of history in terms of its shape at the very least. And there was a little bit of a kind of Yamaha lineage there. I've got an old SG 2000 from, back in the 70s. It's the heaviest known object in the universe. So there was an initial kind of association with that, with a guitar that I already owned. I think as much as anything else, I've kind of grown a little bit bored of Strats. And that's, whenever I say that, it always kind of takes me back to that phrase of, whatever it was, who said it about London, a man who was tired of London is tired of life. It's entirely my kind of shortcoming that I'd kind of grown a little bit kind of tired of Strats. I'd been playing Strats pretty much exclusively, I guess, for a very long time at that point. And I think as much as anything, it was the inevitable categorization that people want to do when you play a guitar that is so identifiable with so many incredible musicians, whether that's, legacy guys, whether it's Hendrix, whether it's Gilmore, whether it's Hank Marvin, whether it's Richie Blackmore, more recently, I guess, guys like John Mayer. And I've kind of grown a little bit tired of that, I think, just that initial kind of categorization of, oh, well, you play a Strat into a relatively clean amp, a little bit pushed. Obviously, there's going to be the inevitable conclusions to draw on. I thought, well, let's try and throw myself creatively, kind of thrust myself into something different, something that doesn't have that level of association, but also, from a kind of public perception kind of standpoint, I guess, let's just play something different. And the idea of it being a new guitar that wasn't obviously derived from a Tele or from a Strat or from a Les Paul or from a, insert guitar name here, immediately kind of drew me in. So obviously the fact that there then was a connection with the guitar, I picked it up. I loved its ergonomic simplicity. I always thought that the three-way switch on the initial kind of iteration was actually better than the five-way switch. They'll probably shoot me for saying that, but obviously they've upgraded to the five-way switch now. Obviously more tonal versatility. I think it's probably convolutes a design that principally I thought was very simple and very straightforward and very effective. Which is why I've got a three-way switch in mind. So there was a lot that drew me to the guitar, not just on a practicality level, but on some subconscious kind of desire to move forward maybe from what I'd kind of, as much as anything else, what I'd pigeonhole myself into in the past couple of years.
Did you find that when you were playing strats, it was not just an aesthetic thing? Like you talked about, people were associating you and your sound with a particular thing. Did you find that it was also affecting your playing? Because I know for me, if I'm playing a strat, it's evoking a certain sound and you want to play to that sound. So was that part of it as well?
Oh, massively so. You know, anyone who kind of says that they aren't guilty of that, being disingenuous, I think it's inevitable that you stick it on the in-between positions, especially more recently in the past couple of years. It's inevitable what you're going to start leaning towards, you know, whether you want to or not. And I just kind of, you know, I think if I was a better musician, maybe I wouldn't be guilty of that so much, you know, but inevitably it's stuff you start to kind of lean on it and it becomes a little bit of a crutch. And it kind of coincided with the launch of Cardinal Black and just wanting to, you know, new band, new start, kind of let's do something creatively different, you know, not just musically, but literally in what I'm playing. And I think it's been effective, you know, it's nice to be associated with a guitar that doesn't really have any kind of prior baggage, I guess, you know, I by default, as much as anything, become one of the kind of main Revstar guys. You know, it's kind of me and Matteo Mancuso that people tend to think of as the guys associated with the Revstar, which is bizarre. Obviously, Matteo was an alien, I think. So to be mentioned in the same breath as him is surreal. But just to be able to have that and kind of build an association with a guitar that's pretty fresh, I thought was quite a cool opportunity.
How has that? Because your gold Revstar was like a custom shop.
Yeah.
And how has that started to break in? Because you've played that guitar a lot. I remember being at NAMM with you when you got it.
Yeah.
Has that grown to like have a real familiarity for you, just being like one of your go-to P90 guitars?
Yeah, definitely. I think purely by virtue of how much I've played it, it's kind of grown to feel like an extension of me. I think there were a little kind of couple of initial hiccups just in terms of the one thing that I spec'd on that guitar, which I loved the idea of in theory, but didn't necessarily work practically, was having two volume controls. I'd love, you know, on Les Paul's, one of my favorite tones is that in-between position and being able to kind of blend in each pickup to taste. Great in theory. In practicality on a Revstar, at the very least, not particularly great because you can't reach the bottom control all that easily to be able to do volume swells or anything like that. I had a couple of rehearsals with it and was just kind of like, this doesn't really work. That has to be a kind of tone control. So I switched that back. So, you know, purely by, like I said, by virtue of how much time I've spent with it since, how much I've gigged it, how much I've recorded with it and, you know, used it at every show and every rehearsal pretty much since I had it, it has kind of become an extension of me. Couple that with the fact that it's a great guitar. It's lively, it's resonant. And, you know, I love the fact that it's kind of age commensurately with me as well. It's very much looking its age now, as am I. So there's a lot to commend that guitar, you know, and I think, again, it's a little bit of a kind of misconception that it's anything wildly different than what was available as standard at the time. It was essentially a standard 502, chambered, which was at their behest more than mine. I think in retrospect, obviously they've gone with chambered on the new Revstar. So I think it was a little bit of a kind of testing ground for that, although I didn't know that at the time. But in terms of profile, neck profile, in terms of body shape, neck joint, everything about that guitar was ostensibly the same as a standard 502 at the time. You know, the wrap over, the two P90s, the three-way toggle, the tone control in the end, everything about that guitar was pretty standard. It was just a kind of a one-man build thing as opposed to, you know, production line.
The Revstars, we've talked about this on the show many times. I think they are some of the most underrated guitars you can get today. And I think part of that is down to Yamaha's branding and not being a super well-known sort of historical brand in the guitar space, even though they have had many, you know, famous players and use cases over the years. But like the Revstar thing, I think just hasn't been around long enough to sort of cement itself with a lot of guitar players as being a great guitar. And I think that's primarily Yamaha's fault. Like they just haven't done a good job of marketing those guitars, because I had one for a while and it was like, it played great. It had all the modern features you want, but it wasn't too left of center. It wasn't too out there. It was super stable. The pickup sounded great. The electronics sounded great. You know, it's got a good shape. So can you speak to that for a bit? Like what, do you think the Revstar thing from your perspective is going to start catching on or has started catching on, or what do you think?
It's difficult to tell. I guess I exist in my own little bubble to a degree, you know, and obviously I guess if the comments that I get on social media are anything to go by in terms of you know, getting the kind of odd comment coming through saying that they bought a RevStar because of me, or you know, they're kind of thinking of getting a RevStar because they've seen so and so playing the Mateo, whatever. It's hard to judge whether that then translates into kind of, you know, word on the street, whether it's really getting out. You know, it's kind of, it's a little bit of a kind of closeted existence that I live online in that respect. But it's hard to say. I guess it will always be something Yamaha struggle with to a degree, is that for one of the, you know, biggest companies in the world, you know, across the kind of depth and breadth of everything that they make, I guess that is as much of a disadvantage as much as it's an advantage when it comes to guitar production and guitar marketing. It's hard to then compete with the likes of quote unquote legacy brands like Fender and like Gibson, you know, even smaller guitar brands, but, you know, kind of whether it's Ibanez or brands ultimately that are exclusively associated primarily, at the very least, with making guitars. That's their thing. That's what they do. They don't also make powerboats or computers or, you know, all of the myriad things which Yamaha make. I guess in terms of public perception of the guitar brand, it probably dilutes that through no fault of their own, I guess, to a degree. And it's probably hard to kind of, you know, counteract that. I guess inevitably, you know, the more that they get people playing them and the more that they actually kind of get them into people's hands and word starts to spread, inevitably word will start to spread. Whether it would ever be to the extent of, you know, in 50 years time, it has the same kind of, you know, cachet as a Les Paul or a Strat or a Tele or whatever, I very much doubt that. But I think in the short term, it's probably a kind of harder job than probably initially acknowledged, maybe, to try and get that generated word of mouth to kind of keep building, you know, when you're up against legacy brands.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they definitely have done that in the piano world. Like, I think Yamaha as a brand is very well established in specifically the piano realm. Like, their upright models or their grand models, like I guess the C2 or C4, I don't know much about piano, so don't kill me in the comments, but they've been around long enough and they've produced enough and they've been used enough on records and big studios and by great musicians for years that they've built that sort of thing. So I think that can happen in the guitar space, but I think you're right, it's just going to take time.
Yeah, I guess it's just a, you know, osmosis. It'll happen over a period of time. You know, like you said, if you go into any kind of major studio in the world, it'll probably be a Yamaha grand piano or a Steinway. You know, it's kind of, they have that kind of gravitas in that kind of world. But I think in the guitar industry, it's a little bit harder to kind of break through and have that association with people.
Nice.
So you're coming to the States soon.
Yeah. Visa pending, assuming they let me in.
Tickets are sold out, you know, like at a couple shows. How are you preparing for this, like, jaunt across the ocean? Have you ever toured in the States?
Never toured in the States. I've played in the States. Never officially. If immigration asked me when I arrived, this is very much my first jaunt across the water. But kind of snuck in on an ESTA, which is the kind of brief form that you have to kind of fill in as a foreigner to come into the US, and pretty much entitles you to kind of tourism purposes, I guess. I did a benefit show for there was a kind of series of wildfires in Arizona back in probably 2013, 2012, something like that. And it was a huge loss of firefighter life. And Alan Niven, my old manager, put on a benefit show and flew me over for that. And it was Slash headlining it. And I was kind of part of Slash's backing band for the evening. But again, kind of snuck in under the radar for that one. So this is very much the first time of, you know, I'm officially arriving and will be probed in every which way they see fit. So yeah, I'm very, very excited for it. We had zero idea or zero expectation of what to how people were going to react when we announced the shows. I guess if YouTube and social media are anything to go by, I guess there was a degree of, you know, kind of anticipation in regard to the shows, but, you know, whether that is going to translate to ticket sales is a very different thing. And we announced a show at the Basement in Nashville, which is quite a small little place. From what, obviously I've never been to Nashville, so this is all hearsay, but I think 150 cap maybe.
So, yeah. Basement East it's a basement under what used to be Grimey's record shop. It's one of my favorite rooms to play in Nashville, though. It's a cool room, of a divey, tight rock club. Stage is kind of at floor level. So
cool.
It's a fun room.
Awesome. I'm looking forward. So it took a little bit of convincing on behalf of the guys that ran the basement. Obviously, it's a guy they've never heard of getting in touch saying, can we rent your venue? So they initially tried to convince me to go on there. I think it's a New Faces night where you're part of a kind of three or four band kind of lineup. And I was like, I think we should be okay to sell 150 tickets. I think we should be good. So it went on sale, and within about 2 hours or whatever it was, it had sold out. So had a phone call from Phil at the basement, which in a roundabout way, the idea of the phone call was, so who the fuck are you guys? And why are people buying tickets? So we upgraded the show to the basement, Basement East rather, and I think we sold over 400 tickets, whatever, and there's a couple of months left. So I think that's heading in the right direction for a sellout as well, which would be cool. And then we're playing the Troubadour in Los Angeles as well. Which is one off my bucket list as a diehard Guns N' Roses fan. That's the one I'm really looking forward to.
Forget what I said about Basement. I didn't realize you had moved to Basement East. Hell yeah, cool. Man.
Yeah. Looking forward to it. It should be good. I've seen a couple of photos of it, and it looks good fun. And then we're playing a festival in Omaha as well, in Nebraska. So it's three shows. The reason we're not doing a kind of fully fledged US tour at this point is that, you know, this trip we're on the cusp of, if we sell out all of the venues, I think we'll probably break even. It is astronomically expensive just to, you know, before we even land in the US, we'll probably be the better part of about $30,000, you know, in the kind of red. So it's a case of then trying to recoup that where possible, you know. So at some point then, hopefully within the very near future, we'll be back and looking to do a full kind of tour.
Yeah, touring is insanely expensive. So, and I think more and more people are starting to realize that now, as artists like yourself are starting to talk about it online. You know, it takes a lot to get a band on the road and into venues. Yeah, totally. I remember the last touring gig I had with Muddy Magnolias before the pandemic. I remember it was something like almost $400 or $4,500 a night to get us just on stage breaking even. And that was pretty slim. Like, that was, you know, not that expensive. So I'm interested to see, because it's like, you know, I look at guys like you with Cardinal Black and Adam Neely, and these sort of YouTubers that start writing and producing their own music, create their own bands. Adam's band Sun Gazer, I've seen them live a few times. They kill it. And that has actually become kind of his primary focus now. And I'm seeing you with Cardinal Black do the same thing. So can you speak to that a little bit? Like, what's been your thought process and strategy behind, you know, are you using your YouTube channel to promote the band, or are you keeping them sort of separate? How do you think about that stuff?
I guess inevitably one feeds into the other. That was, you know, as much as YouTube has been kind of life-changing for me in many ways, you know, it was, looking back, it was very much at my wife's behest, actually, that I started a YouTube channel. Or had a YouTube channel, but I was not uploading to it regularly at all. It was, you know, a very sporadic thing, maybe one video a year of just playing. And I was just getting a little bit frustrated. This is probably back in 2016, 2017, maybe. Getting a bit frustrated with the amount of kind of momentum that I felt like I was generating on other forms of social media, you know, the amount of views that I was getting on Facebook and Instagram in particular, but that wasn't really translating to anything meaningful, but definitely no kind of wage, I guess, no viable sense of this being an income and being a living. And my wife, at a very cursory level, was like, well, why don't you start putting stuff up on YouTube? You know, at least you can kind of get paid for that. She's just upload the stuff that you're uploading to Instagram or Facebook. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I want to do it properly. So let's try creating a kind of series, you know, kind of like a weekly thing. And I had zero concept at the time of what that would entail and how much work that would actually mean, you know, 5 years down the line, 6 years down the line, however far we are, you know, it's been a monumental effort, you know, and it's something I enjoy for the most part. It's a little bit of a kind of millstone around my neck in some respects, just in regards to trying to keep that going amongst other things, amongst touring, amongst having a family, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, as soon as it became clear that I was generating a little bit of a following on Instagram, my first thought was, well, let's try and feed that back into some, you know, something of original music, whether it's live shows, whether it's record sales or whatever, because that's why I started playing guitar. You know, I've always wanted to be in a band. I've always wanted to tour. I've always wanted to make records. I've always wanted to kind of, you know, do that thing. And it only kind of really made sense to, well, let's try and feed that into the band. And, you know, the band got a kind of fairly big kickstart, I guess, off the back of my YouTube channel. However many kind of subscribers I have when we launched, I can't remember. It was about 2-3 years ago, maybe. But in the UK, at the very least, we released Tell Me How It Feels on the Friday. Basically, I uploaded a music video instead of my usual Friday Fretworks. And within 24 hours, that was top of the kind of the rock charts in the UK, you know. Wow. So that kind of gave us a little bit of a kind of kickstart and generated a lot of interest in the band straight off the bat. And it's, to a degree, it's just kind of kept going, you know, albeit not as fast as maybe we'd anticipated it going off the back of that kind of slightly crazy start. But for the most part, it's just kind of seems to keep kind of gathering momentum. Our next tour over in the UK now, we're playing Shepherd's Bush Empire in London, which is, I think, a 2,000 cap. We're doing Rock City in Nottingham, which, again, as a Guns N' Roses fan, I've kind of grown up with tales of those guys playing there. You know, that's a 1,500 capacity room. So we've kind of, in a relatively short time, I guess, we've got to a point where we're playing fairly large venues. We've just done our first kind of proper full tour of Europe around Germany and Austria and Switzerland. You know, playing kind of 500 capacity rooms, I guess, every night. And it feels like it's got to a kind of decent point relatively quickly. You know, that's trying to get that to a point where it's equating to a bit of a wage for everyone in the band is, you know, easier said than done. But it feels like it's kind of heading in the right direction at the very least. And I think the YouTube thing has probably been a massive part of that. You know, I still get people coming up to me at shows and saying, oh, I love Friday Fretworks, or love this, you know, saw this video and kind of thought I'd come and check out what band you're in as a consequence. So it's just marketing. It's just a means to reach more people. It's just another Instagram. It's just another Facebook. It's just another TikTok. It just happens to be, for me at the very least, a little bit more kind of long form media.
So where do you see your future with YouTube? Like if 5 years from now, what's your sort of goal with YouTube? Is it still just sort of like do you want it to be your primary focus or one of your primary focuses? Or would you like to build the band to a point where that is the main thing and YouTube is still just kind of supporting it?
Yeah, the latter, ideally. Whether or not that will happen, I don't know. You know, like I said, we've got to a point relatively quickly where we're playing fairly large venues, but it's still not at a point where we're able to take anything of an equal kind of wage from the band, you know? So I think it speaks to how hard it is to get to that point, not because we're frivolous with money or because we have extravagant outgoings. Like you said, it's just expensive to keep a band on the road. It's expensive to tour. It's expensive to, you know, we're DIY. We're not signed. We're kind of, there's a couple of labels caught in us now for the next record, but everything we've done to this point, from, you know, from vinyl production to, you know, kind of tour support, everything has kind of been in-house. So pretty much every penny that we turn over quite a lot as the band, but all of that money near enough gets reinvested in the band to make sure that something else can happen at the next stage. So getting it to a point where it's lucrative is difficult. And I guess to that end, you know, I probably will still be kind of dabbling in YouTube and stuff in, you know, 4 or 5 years time. Hopefully not to the extent that I am now. And that's not through denigration of YouTube or, you know, kind of being ungrateful for it in any respect. It's just a kind of commitment thing. It just takes up so much time of my week, you know, that I feel would probably be better spent, at least for me, or kind of happier spent with the band and writing and rehearsing, et cetera, et cetera. But like I said, it's just a case of, I don't know, I guess the way I've always looked at my kind of trajectory of my career is that at various points, all of the myriad things which I've done to kind of constitute anything approaching a wage, the moment I don't have to do one of those things that I maybe enjoy slightly less than other things, like teaching, I'm crap at teaching. I don't really understand what I do on guitar. So trying to explain that to someone else is a bloody nightmare, just because I don't, if I don't understand it, how the hell are they going to understand when I'm trying to explain it to them? So as soon as it got to a point where I didn't have to teach, I thought, well, I won't do teaching anymore, just because I'm not very good at it. And I guess that's the kind of way I look at YouTube, in terms of, if I can get to a point where at the very least I don't have to do a video a week, we'll see how that gets, you know, we'll see how I get there. But it's easier said than done, you know. It's just, I think the quality would be better for it as well, you know. It's a big commitment doing one video a week, you know, whilst juggling that with everything else going on in life. And I think if that was one a fortnight, or even, I don't know, one a month, maybe I would be able to do better videos as a consequence, you know. It'd be more effort would go into it. So, but we'll see. For the time being, it's very much quantity over quality. That's my mantra.
Yeah, I feel like with most things, like from my perspective, from business, it's better to bend until you're about to break, because so often like people bite off more than they can chew right out of the gate, especially with touring. Like you were talking about that. Like, I can't imagine, I think like doing it the way you guys have done it, where you're pushing and pushing and pushing until you have to take the next step, is it's the most natural way to do a lot of things, but not everybody like views progression and progress in that manner.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's difficult, and it's, you know, I think Rhett nailed it. You know, I think as long as there's people out there starting to talk about it a little bit more openly about the expenses of being on the road and how difficult it is to kind of get a band to the point where they are going to break, whatever that means. You know, I think it's more power to it, because I think people have a better appreciation of what goes into it. You know, like our kind of daily exposure when we're on the road in terms of how much it costs us to be out, you know, that's food, that's accommodation. And we're eight people. Our touring party is eight people. There's six on stage, there's a driver and a merch guy, and there's a front of house guy, you know. And I mean, we did a tour of Europe recently, and we got pulled over the moment we drove into Austria. Because I think they took one look at the British plate on the back of the van, and that is pretty much a target these days post-Brexit. Took one look at us, pulled us over, weighed us, and we were slightly overweight. So we got fined accordingly, you know, and we weren't actually carrying all that much gear in the van. It was just the fact that there's eight of us, you know, none of which are particularly waif-like. So, you know, it's just stupid stuff like that, you know. I mean, whatever profit margin we had on that tour was eaten into massively by the fines that we had, for one. We had a second fine not long after the first one, because I had the genius idea, well, surely what's the odds of being pulled in twice on the same day for the same thing? Turns out in Austria it's very high. So we had two fines within the space of a couple of hours trying to reach Vienna. And then obviously we had to rent another van for the duration of the tour to split the personnel and the gear over, you know. So just stupid little stuff like that, you know, ate into considerably what was going to be pretty slim profit margin for that tour. So,
yeah,
it's funny how often so many companies like music, you know, guitar brands and pedal companies and whatnot moan about NAMM and the expense of that. And I don't know anything about the cost of touring because I've never done it like seriously, you know. To have a NAMM booth is like minimum 10 grand or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And recouping that is a pain, but like, I had no idea like how, I never even thought about it, that like how much you have to put forth to make a dime on a trip like that.
It's just,
that's why people,
sorry. Right?
Well, I was just going to say, like, if you are going to see a band live, the best thing that you can do to support that band is buy merch at the show. Buy t-shirts, buy whatever they have, because nowadays, especially in the United States, we have this whole thing with the monopoly of Live Nation and Ticketmaster owning most of the venues, and there's a lot of nefarious practices with tickets and all this kind of stuff. So make it a point, you know, it, even if it seems like, man, $45 for a t-shirt, that's really expensive. But the thing is, that's going most of the time directly to the band if it's not being split by the venue. That's the, like, the best thing you can do to support your favorite band on the road, because that's going into their gas tank. It's putting food on their table. It's getting them to the next show and hopefully getting them back home with a little bit of money in their pocket.
Yeah, it's frustrating as well. You know, I think something I've noticed post-pandemic is that the public's ticket buying habits seem to have changed very slightly. I don't know whether it's a subconscious thing, but one thing we've noticed is that, for example, the tour that we just did in Europe, we did, I think, maybe eight shows across Germany, and pretty much every one of those shows, you know, was packed near enough. But we went over with the anticipation of playing to half empty rooms, because all of the ticket updates that we were getting, you know, a good example being Frankfurt. I remember that. I think they were about 450 people in Frankfurt or something. And the week before, and then you're basing your merch numbers that you were taking on the tour on your latest updates, basically. So you're arriving in Frankfurt when a week before, the number you'd been given for the latest sales were like 190, maybe. And you arrive a week later and there's 400 and odd tickets sold. And you're like, so what happened? And they're like, oh, people just buy tickets at the last minute. Like, oh, great. Okay, then that would explain why we suddenly run out of t-shirts very early into the tour. So that's always something to contend with. So straight away on the road, we're scrabbling around trying to find merch production companies in various places across Germany, all of which, again, see band on tour, think, well, they haven't really got many options here. We'll add on the extra zero onto the end of the quote. But also then, you know, like Rhett said, it's not always a case of the merch money going to the bands there, or, you know, kind of wholly anyway. We did a tour with Peter Frampton in the UK back in kind of late 2022. Playing some like pretty big venues. Obviously Peter was doing his kind of finale tour over here, so it was every night it was playing places between like 3,000 and 5,000. The culminating show of that tour was the Royal Albert Hall in London. which for the privilege of playing the Royal Albert Hall took, I want to say 25% of your merch takings. And, you know, it's, again, you know, venues at the time, the people doing this on behalf of the venues know that it's unscrupulous, know that it's not right, because there's a threshold. I can't remember what it was, but it's like a £200 or $200 threshold or something, where if you take less than that, they don't take a percentage. And, you know, one of the nights we took maybe £300 or whatever. And so technically speaking, that's the other frustrating thing that's just come back to me. I thought, well, at that point, they then take their percentage of the what you've exceeded, basically. So if you take £300 and the threshold is £200, they take 20% or whatever the percentage is of the £100. Nope, it's of the £300. So there was actually a night where we lost money on merch because someone came and bought a t-shirt, like literally last going off, and someone sold them that t-shirt. Man. And then we got taxed, basically. Exactly, yeah. I was like, if I'd known, I just could have given them the t-shirt. It would have cost us less. So there's a whole kind of host of bizarre scenarios, you know, which until you actually live them, I was totally naive to. I had no idea that was even a thing, you know. And again, thankfully, more and more people are speaking out about, you know, malpractices like that. You know, how is that even legal? Why does the venue have any bloody, you know, if I'd known, we'd set up a merch store on the pavement outside, you know, on the sidewalk. It's farcical, but such is life.
Could you just say you only have enough stuff to reach £200? And then if there's still a line, then maybe.
Yeah, no, totally. It's a joke, you know, it's just frustrating. And again, like I said, until you actually live these things, it's just totally naive to them. So live and learn.
So let's talk about your playing for a minute. I think you have some of my favorite, you're one of my favorite players because of your phrasing. You have some of the most unique phrasing and sense of melody and time and feel of any of the guitar players that are out there now. I think that's a big reason why you have such a huge following on Instagram and YouTube. People love listening to you play. So can you talk a little bit about that, where that came from? And you mentioned a moment ago that you don't really understand what you're doing. I don't fully believe that. So tell us about that. Like, where did that come from and how do you think about it?
Thank you, first and foremost. I think inevitably you are, anyone is just a culmination of their influences. You know, however much, I don't think anyone has ever ended up sounding like themselves through sitting down and going, right, I'm going to try and sound unique. It just happens over time. It's just an evolution kind of thing. And for me, at least, you know, I had a very long time growing up of idolizing Slash. Slash was the guy, you know, everything about Slash was the coolest thing in the world as far as, you know, kind of 15-year-old kid from Wales was concerned. So, you know, aesthetically trying to replicate his sense of style and how he dressed, you know, all short of just actually wearing a top hat, everything was done pretty much to try and emulate Slash. And, you know, that kind of extended to playing style, needless to say. So there was a very long extended period of time where I just sounded like Slash. And then I guess as I grew older, you start to naturally diversify your influences a little bit and, you know, different guys crept in. You know, I was a big Clapton fan when I was younger, went through the kind of big Stevie Ray phase, all of the inevitable kind of usual suspects, I guess, in that sense. Discovering Derek Trucks was a big one for me. My slide playing is an abomination, so it never once occurred to me to try and, you know, kind of replicate what he was doing in that respect. But there was a kind of vocal effortlessness and kind of fluidity about his playing, which I thought, well, if I can try and capture a degree of that just in quote unquote normal guitar playing, that would be something worth attempting to do. And that naturally then kind of led me to, well, what are his influences? Who is he listening to try and, you know, sound that vocal? And it's, you know, whether it's Aretha, whether it's Otis Redding, whether it's Sam Cooke, all of which I guess were kind of rattling around in the back of my head from my mother's musical influences when I was a kid. You know, she would listen to a lot of Motown stuff. So I think it was just a case of joining the dots as much as anything. And then I guess in retrospect, starting to play with my fingers was probably a quite a big moment. And again, that was, you know, I wish I could claim that was through any great insight or, you know, kind of spark of genius on my part. It was laziness as much as anything else for the moments where I'd be sat on the sofa and I would drop the pick and couldn't be bothered to go and find it. I would start to try and play with my fingers and just try and replicate what I was doing with the pick, which being a big Slash fan, a lot of that was kind of speed based or kind of like faster runs, trying to replicate that with my fingers and trying to get to a point where I'm kind of nearly as dexterous with my fingers as I am with a pick. not quite, which is why I still use a pick all of the time. Well, not all of the time, but a lot of the time. So it's just been a kind of natural evolution, I guess. And then just listening to all of my favorite vocalists, you know, whether, like I said, whether that's Sam Cooke, whether that's more recent guys like Paolo Nutini, you know, or I don't know, anyone, and trying to replicate their kind of their vocal quality, I guess, in my playing. But, you know, I kind of say I don't understand what I'm doing. My theoretical knowledge is sporadic, I guess, is probably the best way of putting it. There are little patches of knowledge in there which sort of sometimes join the dots, and then other times there are just moments where I don't really know my modes. I play in a kind of modal way sometimes, I think, but it's just following my ear and it's following what I've heard other people do or other vocalists do. Nice little kind of, you know, runs or inflections or, you know, kind of melodic ideas, and trying to copy that. And I guess I've spent enough time around a guitar to know where those notes lie for the most part. Mm. But as for the knowledge to come in and join all that up, you know, that will be something I'll get around to in time, I guess. But for the time being, it's just kind of busking it for the most part.
We had a patron ask about, it was Jeremiah, and he said he loves the physicality of your playing, and you have a lot of quick motions, and you pull the guitar neck a lot.
Heavy-handed, like, is the better way of putting it.
where did that sort of thing come from? Because when I think about your playing too, there is like a lot of little quick melodic pieces that there were melodic parts in your playing that like, oh, I can immediately tell that's Chris.
Oh, cool. I think the physicality thing, I think as soon as you start to play with your fingers, I guess in a live context at the very least, it's funny, obviously with Cardinal Black now, I guess we're at a point where we have our own front of house and we're very lucky in that respect. And every night, if I so wished, I could have, you know, a multitude of things in my monitor. I could have in-ears, all of this kind of stuff. But this is the guy who spent 10 plus years playing in function bands, playing weddings, playing funerals. I'd celebrate any religion for the right price. I did so many shows where you kind of, you know, there was no form of monitoring. There was nothing to kind of, you know, rely on in that respect. So I got quite good at mixing myself on stage. And that's a kind of physical thing as much as anything else, that if you're playing with your fingers and you want to make it as loud as when you're playing with a pick, you have to kind of dig in. And I don't know, I'm quite heavy-handed generally. My wife would attest to that much around the house. I'm constantly breaking things, you know, nothing goes unpunished for too long. So I'm just a little bit heavy-handed. I'm a little bit clumsy. If there's something in a room to find and fall over, I will find it. And I guess that translates to the guitar, you know. And, you know, as for the kind of like quick little inflections or whatever you want to call them, I guess, again, that goes back to the kind of vocal thing, you know, trying to replicate the subtle inflections of a vocalist. You know, vocalists tend not to think of notes in the same way that guitarists think of them. Guitarists tend to visualize them as kind of boxes over the fretboard. You know, vocally, it's linear. It's up and down. It's down and up, you know, and that's a lot of the soloing I do is on one string because, again, that's how it seems most natural to kind of reach for the next note, you know, as opposed to jumping around from different notes in different areas and kind of low to high, you know, to middle to low to high to low, whatever, you know, kind of following them up and down sequentially or whatever the phrase would be. So, you know, like I said, there is knowledge joining all of this stuff up in my head to a degree, but it's just, and it's not a case of, it's not any of that nonsense of I'm afraid to learn theory because I think it'll ruin anything. It's just a laziness thing. I can say it's a time thing, and I do lack for time with all of the things that I do, but, you know, I could find it if I was so inclined. I'm just lazy. It's just a lot on, and that doesn't seem to take priority for whatever reason. Sopranos does.
I really resonate with that side of it. You know, I know enough harmony and theory to play what I want to hear. And like, I feel the same way. I could set the time aside to like really dive deep on a lot of these concepts and stuff, but I feel like, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, but as I've gotten into my mid 30s, I've kind of gotten to the point as a guitar player where I not have like gotten as good as I want to be, because I'll always want to progress and get better, but I've gotten to the point where I'm more confident in my sound and my voice, and I can play what I want to hear. And now the ideas that I want to explore musically are sort of adjacent to the guitar. They're more production based. Yeah. They're more writing based. They're more,
yeah, totally.
You know, how do I get different sounds? How do I craft songs? Has that been a similar experience for you?
Absolutely. You kind of feel bad for saying it because it sounds like such an arrogant or kind of grandiose thing to say. And I really don't intend it in such a way, but we've just recorded a live record. We did a show in December and it was recorded, and we kind of sat on it for a little while, not really kind of wanting to go and listen to it. And it turns out it was actually pretty good. So we're going to release that as a live record in the next couple of months. And in listening back to some of the kind of solos and some of the recordings from that night, there's a few moments where I'm like, ordinarily you listen back and you say, well, that could clearly be improved on. I wish I'd done something differently there. But there were a few moments throughout the course of that night where I listened back. Okay, that's kind of, you know, even if I sat down today to re-record that solo or improvised section or whatever, I probably wouldn't do anything different. So in that case, have I peaked? Have I hit my limit? Is that as good as I'm ever going to get? And I should be happy with that. Or, you know, what comes next? You know, because I'm not, there's nothing that I'm hearing that I wanted to play there that I didn't try or I didn't want to approach or didn't feel confident enough to give a go at the very least. Everything that I heard or thought felt musically right or musically apt or musically relevant in that moment, I kind of played, you know? So what comes next, I guess, is the natural kind of conclusion to draw that sort of idea to. And I guess it is just my musical influences evolving and, you know, kind of diversifying a little bit and hearing different things. It's not so much that my ability will improve, but my ear will improve and I will start to hear some outside kind of stuff that I want to try. But then part of me is like, well, I don't want to get too outside because that turns into jazz then and nobody wants that. So, you know, I kind of partly joke, many a true word said in jazz, but yeah, I don't know what comes next, you know. I think I've peaked too early.
I don't think he's just thinking of it as peaking. It's like you're a storyteller and you spend time learning vocabulary and grammar and how stories are structured and learning past stories and what makes them great and what makes them influence people and everything. We all do that as musicians up until a point. And then you kind of get to a point where it's like, okay, now I need to start gaining other experiences outside of this. So I have my own stories to tell.
And
musically that is exactly like that's, you know, it's different for everybody, but it's yeah, I think that's another thing people should start talking about. Cause I feel like a lot of times guitar players online, we tend to just talk about the mechanics, like technique, theory, harmony. I talk about that stuff on my channel all the time. Like, you know, how to get the most out of the cage system or whatever, but it's also okay to say, you know what? I'm good on that stuff for a while. I don't really feel like I need to explore that. I have what I need there. Now I want to go somewhere else and I want to learn. And everything influences everything. So, you know, learning about a certain style of production or listening to a record you've never listened to before is all going to influence and seep into your playing and your vocabulary, whether you want it to or not.
Oh, totally. And, you know, joking aside, you know, all of that stuff that I just said, obviously I'm aware of the fact that that's kind of pride comes before a fall and it's all very much said in jest. I think you hit the nail on the head there in terms of, you know, we are storytellers, you know, and whether it's, it all sounds a little bit kind of pretentious, I guess, but an improvised guitar solo or a kind of a written guitar solo is telling a story. That's the kind of the sole purpose of that at the end of the day. And I guess one thing I definitely want to get better at is kind of telling that story by probably saying less or saying it more effectively. You know, it's all a little bit conceptual and vague, isn't it, when you talk about it in such terms, but there are clips where I watch back of myself live where I'm kind of like, you're just overplaying. You're just playing too much. You're getting caught up. That is, there we go. We found something I need to definitely improve on. I get kind of a little bit adrenaline fueled, I guess, in shows, and inevitably you start to kind of just kind of feed off that to the extent where I just overplay. That's something I'm very, very guilty of. And I watch back live shows where it's like, you know, what are you doing? You're just playing way too much, you know, play half as much and it would sound so much better for it. But you know, it's easier said than done. You know, thankfully the show that we recorded was quite a kind of chilled kind of evening. So I guess there wasn't too much testosterone and adrenaline flying around to turn me into Steve Vai. So
I think a lot of people are coming to hear your guitar playing though, Chris. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't leave them hanging, man.
Like, yeah,
People are coming to those shows because they want to hear you shred. So nice. Should we dip a rig?
Yes. I was just going to say,
yeah, let's do it.
Let me get it pulled up here.
So this is No Holds Barred was the.
No
the
Holds Barred.
Yeah.
Man.
I think.
Brutal honesty. They know what they're signing up for.
I saw this one and I thought, you know. Oh, man.
Ooh. Oh,
there we go. We can kind of see that.
A bit potato quality on my end, but I think I can decipher it.
Well,
what do we have here?
I will describe it to you. So this is Sam I, cover band. He's got a Gibson Explorer with a Helix floor into a Boss Katana that he's using for his stage volume only. The Helix is going out to front of house. And he's mainly using this for ambient cleans, Vox and Marshall tones, and then some high gain angle style things. Just doing a normal smattering of cover tunes. And I don't know, I saw this and I thought, you know, we haven't had anything different like this in a minute. So I like it.
I like this too. You said cover stuff there, he's part
of Riley? Yeah, cover gigs.
I mean, this is a perfect rig for a cover gig, man. Because the Helix is so versatile, you can make it do whatever you want. If you have a good idea of how to program it, or, you know, buy patches that other people have made, you can get some incredibly good sounds out of the Helix. The Explorer is a bold choice.
Yeah.
I love it. I thought it was an Epiphone at first. I couldn't see the headstock, but
yeah, that's a full fat Gibby right there.
I wish I was cool enough to play an Explorer.
Oh yeah, you absolutely are. If you're cool enough to play a Jazzmaster, which
not a fan of Jazzmasters, I take it.
No. I think they look kind of cool. But I digress. I think the Explorer is awesome. It's way easier to play than a V, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
But yeah, I think this is great because for two reasons. The HX floor covers a lot of things. And then if for whatever reason that dies, you do have the Katana there as a failsafe, which could cover most of the stuff. Not as well, but it could do it.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing that would potentially happen with the Helix is it could freeze, which has happened to me once on a gig. And I had to just stop playing, turn it off, and turn it back on, which sucked. But that would be the same amount of time as like unplugging it, plugging into the Katana, getting your sound pulled up there. So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, man, for what this is for, what it's used for, I don't think anything needs to change. Maybe we add a second guitar in there just for some redundancy. I always bring two guitars to a gig, even if I'm only going to play one. I always bring a backup, always a spare.
Have you always done that? Have you ever flown with just a single guitar? Or Chris, have you just one guitar only gigs?
Yeah, not in a very long time, actually. I think naively, as a kid, I probably did a couple of shows where I literally just took the one guitar. I remember frantically restringing at a gig in it was a place called TJ's in Newport in South Wales, which in its own little way was quite legendary. Newport very briefly had this kind of reputation as like the new Seattle of all these kind of up and coming kind of grunge bands, would get, like Nirvana played there. Legend has it Kurt Cobain proposed to Courtney Love in TJ's, all of this kind of stuff, which is probably not true, but TJ's was kind of legendary in its own right. And I remember snapping a string on my Epiphone Les Paul, playing a Teen Spirit night there when I was probably about 14, and being slow clapped by the audience while a singer told incredibly offensive jokes at the crowd. So yeah, there was a lesson to be learned there. So
yeah, anyway. I've always brought two. Again, even if you're not going to play it, leave it in your gig bag off stage, whatever, but just have a second guitar. If you're on a gig, especially if it's a paid thing or you're like a hired gun working for somebody, working for an artist, I think you kind of have an obligation to like show up prepared. And to me, that's part of being prepared, having a backup. So Otherwise though, dude, nothing I would change. I like the Helix. I've not played the Katana before, to be honest with you.
No,
but I'm sure in this context it works great just using it as a monitor for some floor volume. That is the downside of the Helix or any kind of modeler. If you're going direct to front of house, if you don't have any stage volume, I think you are missing something. You really do need to have something on stage moving air, interacting with the guitar to have a complete sort of sound.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah,
that's whenever I do anything with the Helix, invariably kind of have to use a power cab, at which point I kind of always do find myself thinking, well, what's the point? You know, I'm at this point just using a pedal board and ostensibly a combo. Is there any right. point? But it's the versatility and the flexibility, I guess, of the Helix that you would lose at that point. But I've just remembered, actually, I can go one better than not taking a guitar to a show. I took a double gig bag drove 2.5 hours to a show, only to find that I hadn't actually put any guitars in the bag. So I don't know how at any point in loading everything into the car before I left, I didn't realize that it was quite so light. But yeah, that was interesting.
What,
so
did you just borrow somebody's guitar on the gig? Yeah, what happened?
Thankfully, there were a couple of bands on the bill who were kind enough to, one of them was playing a Strat as well. So I just loaned a Strat for the evening. But awesome. Yeah, again, lesson learned.
Well, what would we rate this, fellas?
Okay. The only caveat being I'd throw a second guitar in a gig bag. I'm going to give this 9.0 Scheuels because for what this is used for, I think it's a perfect solution. Wouldn't change it.
Okay.
Yep. I'd go high as well. And there's extra points included for playing an Explorer as well.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, out of 10, what would you give it, Chris?
Yeah, 9. Let's go 9. 9 across
okay.
the board.
That's very generous. I was going to give it a solid 8. I do think... I agree. You need a backup guitar. Get you a Telecaster or maybe just another double humbucker guitar or something. But yeah. Yeah, for sure. Cool rig, Sam.
Great like rig. It. Awesome. Well, cool. Chris, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Thank you so much.
All of your stuff, Cardinal Black stuff, linked in the description box down below, as well as your upcoming tour dates. I think I might try and make it up to Nashville for y'all's set.
Oh, man, awesome. Make a hang. That'd be great if you can. I'm so intrigued by Nashville, having never been before. I've heard many good things, so I'm incredibly excited for that one in particular.
Do you? We can talk about this offline, but do you have any time off before or after that, or are you just in and out?
So we're, I think, driving down from Omaha to Nashville, which I think is about 11 hours maybe. So I think we're maybe looking to stop in St. Louis or something. So we arrive on the day of the show, and then I think the day off of the day after is actually a day off. So yeah, we should have some time.
Okay, cool, yeah. Cool.
Let's get some chicken.
Welcome to touring in the States, by the way. It's
yeah.
Long drives.
Yep. I look forward to it.
Awesome.
Cool. Oh, thanks, boys. Man. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
That was awesome. Anytime I get to talk to Chris, I really enjoy it. You know, he's a good hang.
He is. I like his accent. Yeah.
You know, everything I know about Wales, I've learned from Welcome to Wrexham. And I didn't get to ask him about it. Next time I talk to him, though, I'm going to talk to you about
it. What is that?
Oh,
is that
dude.
The football show?
Yeah, yeah. Genuinely, it's amazing. If you haven't watched, and I'm not a sports fan at all, but Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney bought the Wrexham football team and basically took them. They had been relegated for like 15 years, and it's just this amazing story about the small town in Wales and how much that football team means to the people there. And it's genuinely one of my favorite shows I've ever seen. Welcome to Wrexham. Go check it out. So
awesome. But yeah, Chris, great guy.
But Chris is cool too. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Chris is pretty cool. I don't know. It's not a TV show.
Yeah, yeah. It's not Ryan Reynolds, but you know.
But man, yeah, I just love his guitar playing. I think he is definitely one of those players that in the past couple of years you hear him play and it's an immediate, you know, you immediately recognize.
Yeah, he and I did a Paul Davids video together a few years ago where it was like, you know, Paul had a bunch of a solo over this track and I played my thing and sent it in. And then I felt pretty good about what I played. And then I watched the video and I saw and heard what Chris played. And I was like, God damn it. Like that. He's just on another level of yeah, it's great, man. So
yeah.
Absolutely. Thanks, Chris, for coming on. Shall we shill it up here?
Yeah, I saw you picking at yours earlier, and I want to know what it is.
Okay. So. All right. So one of the things I did last week was I went to Sweetwater for a few days to film and record a special project with a few people. One of those people being Josh Scott from JHS, friend of the show. And if you've not been to Sweetwater in Fort Wayne, Indiana, they have the big store there. And in the back of the store is the used section. So there's like a whole section there that's like traded in and used gear. And there's just shelves and shelves of pedals. So Josh and I walked in and I've learned with him that when he starts grabbing gear off the shelf to pay attention, when he starts grabbing pedals. So he literally walked in, he just starts grabbing stuff and not like super expensive stuff. He starts grabbing like bottom of the shelf pedals that are like under $100, like yeah. Obviously they're covered in dust. They've been sitting there for a while and he'll pull it up and he goes, oh, nobody knows about this, nobody cares about this, but it was used on this record by this amazing sound. Bam. Oh yeah, people don't know this was used by this person. This line is actually whatever. Bam. So one of the things was the Ibanez DE7. He goes, "Do you have one of these?" And I said, "No." He said, "This was $60. He's like, "Just buy it. It's one of the best delays out there, specifically the echo setting." I've seen these around for years, but I'm guilty of just seeing it and seeing how it looks and judging the book by its cover and be like, "Oh, that's probably not."
Well, yeah. Like this?
Yeah, exactly. So, he's like, I've got a whole line of these, whatever. He's like, So I bought it $60 at the behest of one Josh Scott. And, you know, I guess this is a warning. I haven't played it yet. For all I know, it doesn't work. I mean, I haven't plugged it in yet. This will probably be one of those things that if JHS ever makes a video on it, they're going to go on Reverb for like $400 or $500 and people are going to be trying to flip them and scalp them and stuff. But
man,
this has the Josh Scott pedal collector seal of approval right here. So
I remember when that came out. Cause I mean, I remember when the Tone Lock series came out. Cause my first pedal was the Smashbox, the SM7. But the delay, everyone was talking about it because the delay, the echo mode, it sounds really analog and stuff. And it is, it's really good. It's a really good thing. But it's kind of been like a flying under the radar pedal for a while. I'm shocked you never played one.
I know, man. It's just, there's a lot of stuff out there I just haven't experienced yet. And that's how this world is so deep. I will say, like, for a long time, up until recently, I thought they were plastic.
No.
They look plastic, well, but no, it's full metal enclosure.
The only thing about them, and just a caveat to you and anyone else that's ever looking at these, the switch inside it is like, I don't know, a little bit bigger than a grain of rice. It's so small. And if it ever breaks, you can fix it, but it is a whole damn thing getting out.
Well, good news is if it ever breaks, I'm sending it to you. So you can fix it.
Send it to Josh. Leave me out of this. So I showed you this, and I've shown it on the inner Googles, but I don't know if we've really talked about it.
No,
so
we haven't.
I've just been.
You've been on a spree recently.
Have I ever. So I've been spending some money. So this came into my life. This is a Gibson. Jesus. This is a Fender Custom Shop Esquire. Has a left-handed bridge.
It's backwards.
The flipped plate with the Eldred mod. So it's not the normal, like, you know, mud, normal, no tone. Eldred mod, which is like a Cocteau. It's routed for a neck pickup under there. And this was at Groons. And, the neck on it is huge, but nice. It's really comfortable. I did not intend on buying a Tele-shaped object. And this Esquire was hanging on the wall. I picked it up. It's not heavy. And strummed it. And I was like, oh, no. And then I plugged it in. And having this pickup going the other way where the low strings have really tight sound and then the high strings are just softer just a little bit. This is a pickup that you only get in Custom Shop. It's a Broadcaster custom pickup. Super high output. It's like 9K for a, you know, Tele bridge
pickup. That's really hot.
This guitar is amazing. You're going to freak out when you play it. It's amazing.
I've never played a left-handed bridge pickup before.
It makes sense because you would want the low strings to be tight and the high strings to be a little softer.
It is kind of, if you think about it, it does actually make more sense that way. I mean, it looks weird because we've been conditioned to think that that's backwards, but it does make more sense to have the low strings be a little tighter, a little punchier.
But man, Fender Custom Shop quality is no joke. This thing rules. I've bought way too much stuff over the past couple of weeks. You'll see it throughout.
We'll talk about the Lester on the next episode, but I want to hear. I want to play that thing.
Absolutely. So while we wrap up, if you want to learn more about supporting the show over on Patreon, go to patreon.com and the link below down in the description. You can learn about the tiers supporting us, getting part of the Q&A and some of the things that we do over on Patreon.
Yep. And once again, thanks to Chase Bliss for sponsoring today's episode. You can get 10% off your order at chasebliss.com via the discount code in the description box down below. And don't forget, while you're down there, please subscribe. And if you're listening, rate and review the pod. Helps new people find the show. We appreciate it. So with all that, thanks, everyone. Thanks, Chris. And see you on the next one.
See ya.